and fled back down the stairs that led into the city. Roran helped Baldur to his feet, then shouted, "After them!" He grinned, tasting blood. Maybe it wasn't such a bad start after all. That which does not kill. "Stop," said Elva. Aragorn froze with his foot in the air. The girl waved him back, and he retreated. "Jump to there," said Elva. She pointed at a spot a yard in front of him, by the scrollwork. He crouched, then hesitated, as he waited for her to tell him whether it was safe. She stamped her foot and made a sound of exasperation. "It won't work if you don't mean it. I can't tell if something is going to hurt you unless you actually intend to put yourself in danger." She gave him a smile that he found less than reassuring. "Don't worry. I won't let anything happen to you." Still doubtful, he flexed his legs again, and was just about to spring forward when, "Stop!" He cursed and waved his arms as he tried to keep from falling onto the section of floor that would trigger the spikes hidden both above and below. The spikes were the third trap Aragorn and his companions had encountered in the long hallway leading to the golden doors. The first had been a set of hidden pits. The second had been blocks of stone in the ceiling that would have squished them flat. And now the spikes, much like those that had killed Wirden in the tunnels beneath Drasleona. They had seen Murtagh enter the hallway through the open sallyport, but he had made no effort to pursue them without Thorn. After watching for a few seconds, he had disappeared into one of the side rooms, where Arya and Blodgarm had broken the gears and wheels used to open and close the stronghold's main gate. It might take Murtagh an hour to fix the mechanisms, or it might take him minutes. Either way, they dared not dawdle. "Try a little bit farther out," said Elva. Aragorn grimaced, but did as she suggested. "Stop." This time he would have fallen, had Elva not grabbed the back of his tunic. "Even farther," she said. Then, "Stop. Farther." "I can't," he growled, his frustration increasing. "Not without a running start." But with a running start, it would be impossible to stop himself in time, should Elva determine that the jump was dangerous. "What now? If the spikes go all the way to the doors, we'll never reach them." They had already thought of using magic to float over the trap, but even the smallest spell would set it off, or so Elva claimed, and they had no choice but to trust her. "Maybe the trap is meant for a walking dragon," said Arya. "If it's only a yard or two long, Saphira or Thorn could step right over without ever realizing it was there. But if it's 100 feet long, it would be sure to catch them."
"Not if I jump," said Saphira. "100 feet is an easy distance."
Aragorn exchanged concerned glances with Arya and Elva. "Just make sure you don't let your tail touch the floor," he said. "And don't go too far, or you might run into another trap."
"Yes, little one."
Saphira crouched and gathered herself in, lowering her head until it was only a foot or so above the stone. Then she dug her claws into the floor and leaped down the hallway, opening her wings just enough to give herself a bit of lift. To Aragorn's relief, Elva remained silent. When Saphira had gone 2 full lengths of her body, she folded her wings and dropped to the floor with a resounding clatter.
"Safe," she said.
Her scales scraped on the floor as she turned around. She jumped back, and Aragorn and the others moved out of the way to give her room to land on her return.
"Well,"
she said,
"who's first?"
It took her 4 trips to ferry them all across the bed of spikes. Then they continued forward at a swift trot, Arya and Elva again in the lead. They encountered no more traps until they were 3/4 of the way to the gleaming doors, at which point Elva shuddered and raised her small hand. They immediately stopped. "Something will cut us in 2 if we continue," she said. "I'm not sure where it will come from. The walls, I think." Aragorn frowned. That meant that whatever would cut them had enough weight or strength behind it to overcome their wards. Hardly an encouraging prospect. "What if we..." he started to say, then stopped as 20 black-robed humans, men and women alike, filed out of a side passageway and formed a line in front of them, blocking the way. Aragorn felt a blade of thought stab into his mind as the enemy magicians began to chant in the ancient language. Opening her jaws, Saphira raked the spellcasters with a torrent of crackling flame, but it passed harmlessly around them. One of the banners along the wall caught fire, and scraps of smouldering fabric fell to the floor. Aragorn defended himself, but he did not attack in turn. It would take too long to subdue the magicians one by one. Moreover, their chanting concerned him. If they were willing to cast spells before they had seized control of his mind, as well as those of his companions, then they no longer cared if they lived or died, only that they stopped the intruders. He dropped to one knee next to Elva. She was speaking to one of the spellcasters, saying something about the man's daughter. "Are they standing over the trap?" he asked, keeping his voice low. She nodded, never pausing in her speech. Reaching out, he slapped the palm of his hand against the floor. He had expected something to happen, but still he recoiled when a horizontal sheet of metal, 30 feet long and 4 inches thick, shot out of each wall with a terrible screech. The plates of metal caught the magicians between them and cut them in two, like a pair of giant tin snips, then just as quickly retreated back into their hidden slots. The suddenness of it shocked Aragorn. He averted his eyes from the shambles before them. What a horrible way to die! Next to him, Elva gurgled, then slumped forward in a faint. Arya caught her before her head hit the floor. Cradling her with one arm, Arya began to murmur to her in the ancient language. Aragorn consulted with the other elves about how best to bypass the trap. They decided that the safest way would be to jump over it, as they had with the bed of spikes. 4 of them climbed onto Saphira, and she was just about to spring forward, when Elva cried out in a weak voice, "Stop! Don't!" Saphira flicked her tail, but remained where she was. Elva slid out of Arya's grasp, staggered a few feet away, leaned over, and was sick. She wiped her mouth on the back of her hand, then stared at the mangled bodies that lay before them, as if fixing them in her memory. Still staring at them, she said, "There is another trigger, halfway across in the air. If you jump..." She clapped her hands together, a loud, sharp sound, and made an ugly face. "Blades come out from high on the walls, as well as lower." A thought began to bother Aragorn. "Why would Galbatorix try to kill us? If you weren't here," he said, looking at Elva, "Saphira might be dead right now. Galbatorix wants her alive, so why this?" He gestured at the bloody floor. "Why the spikes and the blocks of stone?" "Perhaps," said the elf woman Invidia, "he expected the pits to capture us before we reached the rest of the traps."
"Or perhaps," said Blodgarm in a grim voice, "he knows that Elva is with us, and what she is capable of." The girl shrugged. "What of it? He can't stop me." A chill crept through Aragorn. "No, but if he knows of you, then he might be scared, and if he's scared..."
"Then he might really be trying to kill us,"
Saphira finished. Arya shook her head.
"It doesn't matter. We still have to find him."
They spent a minute discussing how to get past the blades, whereupon Aragorn said,
"What if I used magic to transport us over there, the way Arya sent Saphira's egg to the spine?"
He gestured toward the area past the bodies.
"It would require too much energy," said Glaedah. "Better to conserve our strength for when we face Galbatorix,"
Umarov added. Aragorn gnawed on his lip. He looked back over his shoulder and was alarmed to see far behind them Murtagh running from one side of the hallway to the other.
"We don't have long. Maybe we could put something into the walls to keep the blades from coming out." "The blades are sure to be protected from magic,"
Arya pointed out.
"Besides, we don't have anything with us that could hold them back. A knife? A piece of armor? The plates of metal are too big and heavy. They would tear past whatever was in front of them, as if it were not there.
Silence fell upon them. Then Blodgam licked his fangs and said, "Not necessarily." He turned and placed his sword on the floor in front of Aragorn, then motioned for the elves under his command to do the same. 11 blades in total they laid before Aragorn.
"I can't ask you to do this," he said. "Your swords..."
Blodgam interrupted with a raised hand, his fur glossy in the soft light of the lanterns.
"We fight with our minds, Shadeslayer, not our bodies. If we encounter soldiers, we can take what weapons we need from them. If our swords are of more use here and now, then we would be foolish to retain them merely for reasons of sentiment."
Aragorn inclined his head.
"As you wish."
To Arya, Blodgam said,
"It should be an even number if we are to have the best chance of success."
She hesitated, then drew her own thin-bladed sword and placed it among the others.
"Consider carefully what you are about to do, Aragorn," she said. "These are storied weapons all. It would be a shame to destroy them and gain nothing by it."
He nodded, then frowned, concentrating as he recalled his lessons with Oromis.
"Umaroth," he said, "I'll need your strength."
"What is ours is yours," the dragon replied.
The illusion that hid the slots from which the sheets of metal slid out was too well constructed for Aragorn to pierce. This was as he expected. Galbatorix was not one to overlook such a detail. On the other hand, the enchantments responsible for the illusion were easy enough to detect, and by them he was able to determine the exact placement and dimensions of the openings. He could not tell exactly how far back the sheets of metal lay within the slots. He hoped it was at least an inch or two from the outer surface of the wall. If they were closer, his idea would fail, for the king was sure to have protected the metal against outside tampering. Summoning the words he needed, Aragorn cast the first of the 12 spells he intended to use. One of the elves' swords, Laufin's, he thought, disappeared with a faint breath of wind, like a tunic being swung through the air. A half-second later, a solid thud emanated from the wall to their left. Aragorn smiled. It had worked. If he had tried to send the sword through the sheet of metal, the reaction would have been substantially more dramatic. Speaking faster than before, he cast the rest of the spells, embedding 6 swords within each wall, each sword 5 feet from the next. The elves watched him intently as he spoke. If the loss of their weapons upset them, they did not show it. When he had finished, Aragorn knelt by Arya and Elva, who were both once more holding the Dalthdet, and said, "Get ready to run." Saphira and the elves tensed. Arya had Elva climb onto her back while still maintaining her hold on the green lance. Then Arya said, "Ready." Reaching forward, Aragorn again slapped the floor. A jarring crash sounded from each wall, and threads of dust fell from the ceiling, blossoming into hazy plumes. The moment he saw that the swords had held, Aragorn dashed forward. He had barely taken 2 steps when Elva screamed, "Faster!" Roaring with the effort, he forced his feet to strike the ground even harder. To his right, Saphira ran past, head and tail low, a dark shadow at the edge of his vision. Just as he reached the far side of the trap, he heard the snap of breaking steel, and then the cringe-inducing shriek of metal scraping against metal. Behind him, someone shouted. He twisted as he flung himself away from the noise, and he saw that everyone had crossed the space in time, save the silver-haired elf woman, Yela, who had been caught between the last 6 inches of the 2 pieces of metal. The space around her flared blue and yellow, as if the air itself was burning, and her face contorted with pain. "Flauger!" shouted Blodgam, and Yela flew out from between the sheets of metal, which snapped together with a ringing clang. Then they retreated into the walls with the same terrible shrieking that had accompanied their appearance. Yela had landed on her hands and knees close to Aragorn. He helped her to her feet,
To his surprise, she seemed unharmed. "Are you hurt?" he asked. She shook her head. "No, but my warts are gone." She lifted her hands and stared at them with an expression close to wonder. "I've not been without warts since I was younger than you are now. Somehow the blades stripped them from me." "You're lucky to be alive," said Aragorn. He frowned.
Elva shrugged. "We would have all died except for him," she pointed at Blodgarm, "if I hadn't told you to move faster."
Aragorn grunted. They continued on their way, expecting with every step to find another trap. But the rest of the hallway proved to be free of obstacles, and they reached the doors at the end without further incident. Aragorn looked up at the shining expanse of gold. Embossed across the doors was a life-sized oak tree, the leaves of which formed an arching canopy that joined with the roots below to inscribe a great circle about the trunk. Sprouting from either side of the trunk's midsection were two thick bundles of branches, which divided the space within the circle into quarters. In the top left quarter was a carving of an army of spear-bearing elves marching through a thick forest. In the top right quarter were humans building castles and forging swords. In the bottom left, Urgles, Kull mostly, burning down a village and killing the inhabitants. In the bottom right, dwarves mining caves filled with gems and veins of ore. Amid the roots and branches of the oak, Aragorn spotted weircats and a razak, as well as a few small, strange-looking creatures that he failed to recognize. And coiled in the very center of the bole of the tree was a dragon that held the end of its tail in its mouth, as if biting itself. The doors were beautifully crafted. Under different circumstances, Aragorn would have been content to sit and study them for most of a day. As it was, the sight of the shining doors filled him with dread as he contemplated what might lie on the other side. If it was Galbatorix, then their lives were about to change forever, and nothing would ever be the same, not for them and not for the rest of Alagasia. "I'm not ready," Aragorn said to Saphira.
"When will we ever be ready?" she replied.
She flicked out her tongue, tasting the air. He could feel her nervous anticipation.
"Galbatorix and Shrukan must be killed, and we are the only ones who might be able to do it."
"What if we can't?"
"Then we can't, and what will be, will be."
He nodded and took a long breath. "I love you, Saphira."
"I love you too, little one."
Aragorn stepped forward. "Now what?" he asked, trying to hide his uneasiness. "Should we knock?"
"First, let's see if it's open," said Arya.
They arranged themselves in a formation suitable for battle. Then Arya, with Elva next to her, grasped a handle set within the left-hand door and prepared to pull. As she did, a column of shimmering air appeared around Blodgarm and each of his 10 spellcasters. Aragorn shouted with alarm, and Saphira released a short hiss as if she had stepped upon something sharp. The elves seemed unable to move within the columns, even their eyes remained motionless, fixed upon whatever they had been looking at when the spell took effect. With a heavy clank, a door in the wall to the left slid open, and the elves began to move toward it, like a procession of statues gliding across ice. Arya lunged toward them, barbed spear extended before her, in an attempt to cut through the enchantments binding the elves. But she was too slow, and she could not catch them.
"Let her!" shouted Aragorn. "Stop!"
The simplest spell he could think of that might help. However, the magic that imprisoned the elves proved too strong for him to break, and they disappeared within the dark opening, the door slamming shut behind them. Dismay swept through Aragorn. Without the elves! Arya pounded on the door with the butt of the Dauntlet, and she even tried to find the seam between the door and the wall with the tip of the blade, as she had with the sallyport. But the wall seemed solid, immovable.
When she turned around, her expression was one of cold fury.
"Umaroth," she said, "I need your help to open this wall."
"No,"
said the white dragon.
"Galbatorix is sure to have hidden your companions well. Trying to find them will only waste energy and place us in even greater danger."
Arya's slanting eyebrows drew closer as she scowled.
"Then we play into his hand, Umaroth Elder. He wants to divide us and make us weaker. If we continue without them, it will be that much easier for Galbatorix to defeat us."
"Yes, little one. But think you not also that the Eggbreaker might want us to pursue them? He might want us to forget him in our anger and concern, and thus to rush blindly into another of his traps."
"Why would he go to so much trouble? He could have captured Aragorn, Saphira, you and the rest of the Eldonari, even as he captured Blodgarm and the others. But he didn't."
"Perhaps because he wants us to exhaust ourselves before we confront him, or before he attempts to break us."
Arya lowered her head for a moment, and when she looked up, her fury had vanished, at least on the surface, replaced by her usual controlled watchfulness.
"What, then, should we do, Eberthil?"
"We hope that Galbatorix will not kill Blodgarm or the others, not immediately at least. And we continue on until we find the king."
Arya acquiesced, but Aragorn could tell that she found it distasteful. He could not blame her. He felt the same.
"Why didn't you sense the trap?"
he asked Elva in an undertone. He thought he understood, but he wanted to hear it from her.
"Because it didn't hurt them," she said.
He nodded. Arya strode back to the golden doors and again grasped the handle on the left. Joining her, Elva wrapped her small hand around the shaft of the Dauthdert. Leaning away from the door, Arya pulled and pulled, and the massive structure slowly began to swing outward. No one human, Aragorn was sure, could have opened it, and even Arya's strength was barely sufficient. When the door reached the wall, Arya released it, and then she and Elva joined Aragorn in front of Saphira. On the other side of the cavernous archway was a huge, dark chamber. Aragorn was unsure of its size, for the walls lay hidden in velvet shadows. A line of flameless lanterns mounted on iron poles ran straight out from either side of the entranceway, illuminating the patterned floor and little else, while a faint glow came from above, through crystals set within the distant ceiling. The two rows of lanterns ended over 500 feet away, near the base of a broad dais, upon which rested a throne. On the throne sat a single black figure, the only figure in the whole room, and on his lap lay a bare sword, a long white splinter that seemed to emit a faint glow. Aragorn swallowed and tightened his grip on Brisinger. He gave Saphira's jaw a quick rub with the edge of his shield, and she flicked out her tongue in response. Then, by unspoken consent, the four of them started forward. The moment they were all in the throne room, the golden door swung shut behind them. Aragorn had expected as much, but still the noise of it closing made him start. As the echoes faded to dusky silence within the High Presence chamber, the figure upon the throne stirred as if waking from sleep. And then a voice such as Aragorn had never heard before, deep and rich, and imbued with authority greater than that of Arjahad or Oromis or Hrothgar, a voice that made even the elves seem harsh and discordant, rang forth from the far side of the throne room. And it said,
"Ah, I have been expecting you. Welcome to my abode. and welcome to you in particular, Aragorn Shadeslayer, and to you, Saphira Brightscales. I have much desired to meet with you. But I am also glad to see you, Arya, daughter of Islanzadi, and Shadeslayer in your own right. And you as well, Elva, she of the Shining Brow. And of course, Gleda, Umaroth, Valder, and those others who travel with you unseen. I had long believed them to be dead, and I am most glad to learn otherwise. Welcome all. We have much to talk about.
The Heart of the Fray. Along with the warriors of his battalion, Roran fought his way down off Urabane's outer wall to the streets below. There they paused to regroup, then he shouted, "To the gate!" and pointed with his hammer. He and several men from Carvajal, including Horst and Delwyn, took the lead as they trotted along the inside of the wall toward the breach the elves had created with their magic. Arrows flitted over their heads as they ran, but none were aimed at them specifically, and he did not hear any of their group take a wound. They encountered dozens of soldiers in the narrow space between the wall and the stone houses. A few paused to fight, but the rest ran, and even those who fought soon retreated down the adjoining alleyways. At first, the savage intensity of slaughter and victory blinded Roran to all else. But when the soldiers they met continued to flee, a sense of unease began to gnaw at his stomach, and he began to look around with greater alertness, searching for anything that seemed different from what it ought to be. Something was wrong. He was sure of it. Galbatorix wouldn't let them give up this easily, he muttered to himself. What? Asked Albrecht, who was next to him. I said Galbatorix wouldn't let them give up this easily. Twisting his head around, Roran shouted to the rest of the battalion, Pin back your ears and look sharp! Galbatorix has a surprise or two in store for us, I wager. We won't let ourselves get caught unawares, though, now will we? Stronghammer! They shouted in return, and pounded their weapons against their shields. All but the elves, that was. Satisfied, he quickened the pace, even as he continued to scan the rooftops. They soon broke out into the rubble-strewn street that led to what had once been the main gate of the city. Now all that was left was a gaping hole several hundred feet wide at the top, with a pile of broken stones at the bottom. Through the gap streamed the Varden and their allies, men, dwarves, urgles, elves, and weircats, fighting alongside one another for the first time in history. Arrows rained down on the army as it poured into the city, but the elves' magic stopped the deadly darts before they could cause harm. The same did not hold true for Galbatorix's soldiers. Roran saw a number of them fall to the Varden's archers, although some appeared to have wards that protected them from the arrows. Galbatorix's favorites, he assumed. As his battalion joined the rest of the army, Roran spotted Jormunda riding in the press of warriors. Roran called out greetings, and Jormunda replied in kind and shouted, Once we reach that fountain! He pointed with his sword toward a large, ornate edifice that stood in a courtyard several hundred yards in front of them. Take your men and head off to the right. Clear the southern part of the city, then meet back up with us at the citadel. Roran nodded, exaggerating the movement so Jormunda would see. Sir! He felt safer now that they had the company of other warriors. But still his sense of unease continued. Where are they? He wondered, looking at the mouths of the empty streets. Galbatorix had supposedly gathered the whole of his army in Urabane, but Roran had yet to see evidence of a large force of men. There had been surprisingly few soldiers on the walls, and those who were present had fled far sooner than they should have. He's luring us in, Roran realized with sudden certainty. It's all a play designed to trick us. Catching Jormunda's attention again, he shouted, Something's wrong! Where are the soldiers? Jormunda frowned and turned to speak with King Orin and Queen Islanzadi, who had ridden up to him. Oddly enough,
A white raven sat on Islanzadi's left shoulder, his claws hooked into her corselet of golden armor. And still the Vardan continued to march deeper and deeper into Urabane.
"What is the matter, Stronghammer?"
growled Nargajvog as he pushed his way over to Roran. Roran glanced up at the heavy-headed Kull.
"I'm not sure. Galbatorix..."
He forgot whatever else he was going to say when a horn sounded among the buildings ahead of them. It blared for the better part of a minute, a low, ominous tone that caused the Vardan to pause and look around with concern. Roran's heart sank. "This is it," he said to Ulbrich. Turning, he waved his hammer, motioning toward the side of the street.
"Move over!" he bellowed. "Get between the buildings and take cover!"
It took his battalion longer to extricate itself from the column of warriors than it had to join it. Frustrated, Roran continued shouting, trying to get them to move faster.
"Quickly, you sorry dogs! Quickly!"
The horn sounded again, and Jormungandr finally called a halt to the army. By then, Roran's warriors were safely wedged into three streets, where they stood clustered behind buildings, waiting for his orders. He stood by the side of a house, along with Gajvarg and Horst, peering around the corner as he tried to see what was happening. Once more, the horn sounded, and then the tramp of many feet echoed through Urabane. Dread crawled through Roran as he saw rank after rank of soldiers march into the streets leading from the citadel, the rows of men brisk and orderly, their faces devoid of even the slightest hint of fear. At their head rode a squat, broad-shouldered man upon a grey charger. He wore a gleaming breastplate that bulged over a foot outward, as if to accommodate a large belly. In his left hand he carried a shield painted with the device of a crumbling tower upon a bare stone peak. In his right hand he carried a spiked mace that most men would have found difficult to lift, but that he swung back and forth with ease. Roran wet his lips. He guessed that the man was none other than Lord Bast, and if even half the things he had heard about the man were true, then Bast would never ride straight at an opposing force unless he was utterly certain of destroying it. Roran had seen enough. Pushing himself off the corner of the building, he said, "We're not going to wait. Tell the others to follow us."
"You mean to run away, Stronghammer?"
rumbled Nargajvarg.
"No," said Roran. "I mean to attack from the side. Only a fool would attack an army like that head on. Now go!"
He gave the Urgle a shove, then hurried down the cross street to take his position at the front of his warriors. "And only a fool would go head to head with the man Galbatorix has chosen to lead his forces." As they made their way between the densely packed buildings, Roran heard the soldiers start to chant,
"Lord Bast! Lord Bast! Lord Bast!"
And they stamped the ground with their hobnail boots and banged their swords against their shields. "Better and better," Roran thought, wishing he were anywhere but there. Then the Vardan shouted in return, the air filled with cries of "Aragorn! And the riders!" And then the city rang with the sounds of clashing metal and the screams of wounded men. When his battalion was level with what Roran guessed was the midpoint of the Empire's army, he had them turn and start in the direction of their enemies.
"Stay together," he ordered. "Form a wall with your shields, and whatever you do, make sure you protect the spellcasters."
They soon spotted the soldiers in the street, spearmen mostly, pressed close against one another as they shuffled toward the front of the battle. Nargajvog let out a ferocious bellow, as did Roran and the other warriors in the battalion, and they charged toward the ranks of men. The soldiers shouted with alarm, and panic spread among them as they scrambled backward, trampling their own kind as they tried to find room to fight. Howling, Roran fell upon the first row of men. Blood sprayed around him as he swung his hammer and felt metal and bone give way. The soldiers were so tightly packed that they were nearly helpless. He killed four of them before even one managed to swing a sword at him, which he blocked with his shield. By the edge of the street, Nargajvog knocked down six men with a single blow of his club.
The soldiers started to climb back to their feet, ignoring injuries that would have crippled them had they been able to feel pain. And Gargevarg struck again, pounding them to a pulp. Roran was aware of nothing but the men in front of him, the weight of his hammer in his hand, and the slipperiness of the blood-coated cobblestones under his feet. He broke and he battered, he ducked and he shoved, he growled and he shouted, and he killed and he killed and he killed. Until to his surprise he swung his hammer and found nothing but empty air before him. His weapon bounced against the ground, striking sparks from the cobblestones, and a painful jolt ran up his arm. Roran shook his head, his battle rage clearing. He had fought his way completely through the mass of soldiers. Spinning around, he saw that most of his warriors were still engaged with soldiers to his right and left. Loosing another howl, he dove back into the fray. Three soldiers closed in on him, two with spears, one with a sword. Roran lunged at the man with the sword, but his foot slipped beneath him as he stepped on something soft and wet. Even as he fell, he swung his hammer at the ankles of the nearest man. The soldier danced back and was about to bring his sword down on Roran when an elf leaped forward and with two quick strokes beheaded all three soldiers. It was the same elf woman he had spoken to outside the city walls, only now splattered with stripes of gore. Before he could thank her, she darted past, her sword a blur as she cut down more of the soldiers. After watching them in action, Roran decided that each elf was worth at least five men, not even counting their ability to cast spells. As for the Urgals, he just did his best to stay out of their way, especially the Cull. They seemed to make little distinction between friend and foe once roused, and the Cull was so big it was easy for them to kill someone without meaning to. He saw one of them crush a soldier between his leg and the side of a building and not even notice. Another time he saw a Cull behead a soldier with an inadvertent swipe of a shield while turning about. The fighting continued for another few minutes, whereupon the only soldiers remaining in the area were dead soldiers. Wiping the sweat from his brow, Roran glanced up and down the street. Farther into the city, he saw remnants of the force they had destroyed disappearing between the houses as the men ran to join another part of Galbatorix's army. He considered pursuing them, but the main battle lay closer to the edge of the city, and he wanted to fall upon the rear of the attacking soldiers and disrupt their lines. "This way!" he shouted, raising his hammer and starting down the street. An arrow buried itself in the edge of his shield, and he looked up to see the silhouette of a man sliding below the peak of a nearby roof. When Roran emerged from between the close-set buildings into the open area before the remnants of Urabane's front gate, he found a scene of such confusion that he hesitated, unsure of what to do. The two armies had mingled together until it was impossible to determine lines or ranks, or even where the front of the battle was. The crimson tunics of the soldiers were scattered throughout the square, sometimes singly, sometimes in large clusters, and the fighting had spilled into all of the nearby streets, the armies spreading outward like a stain. Among the combatants Roran expected to see, he also spotted scores of cats, ordinary cats, not werecats, attacking the soldiers, a savage and frightening a sight as he had ever beheld. The cats, he knew, followed the direction of the werecats. And in the center of the square, sitting upon his grey charger, was Lord Bast, his large round breastplate gleaming with the light of the fires burning in nearby houses. He swung his mace again and again, faster than any human ought to have been able to, and with every blow he slew at least one of the Varden. Arrows fired at him vanished in puffs of sickly orange flame, swords and spears bounced off him as if he were made of stone, and even the strength of a charging Cull was not enough to knock him off his steed. Roran watched with astonishment as with a casual swipe of his mace, the armor-clad man brained an attacking Cull, breaking his horns and skull as easily as an eggshell. Roran frowned. "How can he be so strong and fast?" Magic was the obvious answer, but that magic had to have a source.
There were no gems upon Bast's mace or armor, nor could Roran believe that Galbatorix would be feeding energy to Bast from a distance. Roran remembered his conversation with Aragorn the night before they rescued Katrina from Helgrind. Aragorn had told him that it was basically impossible to alter a human's body to have the speed and strength of an elf, even if the human was a rider, which made what the dragons had done to Aragorn during the Blood Oath celebration all the more amazing. It seemed unlikely that Galbatorix could have managed a similar transformation with Bast, which again made Roran wonder, where was the source of Bast's unnatural might? Bast pulled on the reins of his steed, turning the horse around. The light moving across the surface of his swollen breastplate caught Roran's attention. Roran's mouth went dry, and he felt a sense of despair. From what he knew, Bast was not the sort of man to have a belly. He would not let himself go soft, nor would Galbatorix have chosen such a man to defend Urabane. The only explanation that made sense, then, was that Bast had an Eldunari strapped to his body underneath his oddly shaped breastplate. Then the street shook and split, and a dark crevice appeared beneath Bast and his charger. The hole would have swallowed them both, with room to spare. But the horse remained standing upon thin air, as if its hooves were still planted firmly upon the ground. A wreath of different colours flickered around Bast, like a nimbus of tattered rainbows. Alternating waves of heat and cold emanated from his location, and Roran saw tendrils of ice crawling up from the ground, seeking to wrap themselves around the horse's legs and hold them in place. But the ice could not grip the horse, nor did any of the magic seem to have an effect on either the man or the animal. Bast pulled on the reins again, then spurred his horse toward a group of elves who stood beside a nearby house, chanting in the ancient language. It was they, Roran assumed, who had been casting the spells against Bast. Lifting his mace above his head, Bast charged into the midst of the elves. They scattered, seeking to defend themselves, but to no avail, for Bast split their shields and broke their swords. And when he struck, the mace crushed the elves as if their bones were as thin and hollow as those of birds. Why didn't their wards protect them? Roran wondered. Why can't they stop him with their minds? He's only one man, and there's only one Eldunari with him. A few yards away, a large round stone crashed into the sea of struggling bodies, leaving behind a bright red smear, and bounced into the front of a building, where it shattered the statues above the doorframe. Roran ducked and cursed as he looked for where the stone had come from. Halfway across the city, he saw that Galbatorix's soldiers had retaken the catapults and other war machines mounted on the curtain wall. "They're firing into their own city," he thought. "They're firing at their own men!" With a growl of disgust, he turned away from the square, so that he was facing the interior of the city. "We can't help here!" he shouted to the battalion. "Leave Bast to the others! Take the street over there!" He pointed to his left. "We'll fight our way to the wall, and make our stand there!" If the warriors responded, he did not hear, for he was already moving. Behind him, another stone crashed into the fighting armies, causing even more screams of pain. The street Roran had chosen was full of soldiers, as well as a few elves and weircats, who were clumped together by the front door of a hatter's shop, hard-pressed to fend off the large number of enemies around them. The elves shouted something, and a dozen soldiers fell to the ground, but the rest remained standing. Diving into the midst of the soldiers, Roran again lost himself in the red-tinged haze of battle. He leaped over one of the fallen soldiers and brought his hammer down on the helm of a man with his back turned. Confident that the man was dead, Roran used his shield to shove the next soldier back, and then jabbed with the end of his hammer at the man's throat, crushing it. Next to him, Delwyn caught a spear in his shoulder and went down on one knee with a cry of pain. Swinging his hammer even faster than normal, Roran drove back the spearman, while Delwyn pulled the weapon out and got back to his feet. "Fall back," Roran told him. Delwyn shook his head, teeth bared. "No, Fall back, blast you! That's an order!
Delwyn cursed, but he obeyed, and Horst took his place. The smith, Roran noticed, was bleeding from cuts on his arms and legs, but they did not seem to interfere with his ability to move. Evading a sword thrust, Roran took a step forward. He seemed to hear a faint rushing sound behind him, and then a thunderclap went off in his ears, and the earth spun around him, and everything went black. He woke with a throbbing head. Above, he saw the sky, bright now with the light from the rising sun, and the dark underside of the crevice-lined overhang. Groaning with pain, he pushed himself upright. He was lying at the base of the city's outer wall, next to the bloody fragments of a stone from a catapult. His shield was missing, as was his hammer, which concerned him in a befuddled sort of way. Even as he tried to regain his bearings, a group of five soldiers rushed at him, and one of the men stabbed him in the chest with a spear. The point of the weapon drove him back against the wall, but it did not pierce his skin. "Grab him!" shouted the soldiers, and Roran felt hands take hold of his arms and legs. He thrashed, trying to wrench free, but he was still weak and disoriented, and there were too many soldiers for him to overpower. The soldiers struck at him again and again, and he felt his strength fading as his wards shielded him from the blows. The world grew grey, and he was about to lose consciousness again, when the blade of a sword sprouted from the mouth of one of the soldiers. The soldiers dropped him, and Roran saw a dark-haired woman whirling among them, swinging her sword with the practiced ease of a seasoned warrior. Within seconds, she killed the five men, although one of them managed to give her a shallow cut along her left thigh. Afterward, she offered him her hand and said, "Strong hammer." As he grasped her forearm, he saw that her wrist, where her worn bracer did not cover it, was layered with scars, as if she had been burned or whipped nearly to the bone. Behind the woman stood a pale-faced teenage girl, clad in a piecemeal collection of armor, and also a boy, who looked a year or two younger than the girl. "Who are you?" he asked, standing. The woman's face was striking, broad and strong-boned, with the bronzed, weather-beaten look of one who had spent most of her life outdoors. "A passing stranger," she said. Bending at the knees, she picked up one of the soldier's spears and handed it to him. "My thanks." She nodded, and then she and her young companions trotted off among the buildings, heading farther into the city. Roran stared after them for a half-second, wondering, then shook himself and hurried back along the street to rejoin his battalion. The warriors greeted him with shouts of astonishment and, heartened, attacked the soldiers with renewed vigour. However, as Roran took his place along with the other men from Carverhall, he discovered that the stone that had struck him had also killed Delwyn. His sorrow quickly turned to rage, and he fought with even greater ferocity than before, determined to help end the battle as soon as possible. The Name of All Names. Afraid but determined, Aragorn strode forward with Arya, Elva, and Saphira toward the dais where Galbatorix sat relaxed upon his throne. It was a long walk, long enough that Aragorn had time to consider a number of strategies, most of which he discarded as impractical. He knew that strength alone would not be enough to defeat the king. It would require cunning as well, and that was the one thing he felt he most lacked. Still, they had no choice now but to confront Galbatorix. The two rows of lanterns that led to the dais were wide enough apart that the four of them were able to walk side by side. For that, Aragorn was glad, as it meant Saphira would be able to fight next to them if need be. As they approached the throne, Aragorn continued to study the chamber around them. It was, he thought, a strange room for a king to receive guests in. Aside from the bright path that lay before them, most of the space was hidden within impenetrable gloom, even more so than the halls of the dwarfs beneath Tronchim and Farthendur, and the air contained a dry, musky scent that seemed familiar, even though he could not place it.
"Where is Shrukan?"
he said in an undertone. Saphira sniffed.
"I can smell him, but I don't hear him."
Elva frowned.
"Nor can I feel him."
When they were perhaps 30 feet from the dais, they halted. Behind the throne hung thick black curtains made of velvety material, which stretched up toward the ceiling. A shadow lay over Galbatorix, concealing his features. Then he leaned forward into the light, and Aragorn saw his face. It was long and lean, with a deep brow and a blade-like nose. His eyes were hard as stones, and they showed little white around the irises. His mouth was thin and wide, with a slight downturn at the corners, and he had a close-cropped beard and mustache, which, like his clothes, were black as pitch. In age he appeared to be in his 4th decade, still at the height of his strength, yet near the beginning of his decline. There were lines on his brow and on either side of his nose, and his tanned skin had a thin look to it, as if he had eaten nothing but rabbit meat and turnips through the winter. His shoulders were broad and well-built, and his waist trim. Upon his head was a crown of reddish gold, set with all manner of jewels. The crown appeared old, older even than the hall, and Aragorn wondered if perhaps it had once belonged to King Palancar, many hundreds of years ago. On Galbatorix's lap rested his sword. It was a rider's sword, that much was obvious, but Aragorn had never seen it like before. The blade, hilt, and crossguard were stark white, while the gem within the pommel was as clear as a mountain spring. Altogether, there was something about the weapon that Aragorn found unsettling. Its color, or rather its lack of color, reminded him of a sun-bleached bone. It was the color of death, not life, and it seemed far more dangerous than any shade of black, be it ever so dark. Galbatorix examined them each in turn, with his sharp, unblinking gaze.
"So you have come to kill me," he said. "Well then, shall we begin?"
He lifted his sword and spread his arms to either side in a welcoming gesture. Aragorn widened his stance and raised his sword and shield. The king's invitation unsettled him. "He's playing with us." Still keeping hold of the Dathdet, Elva stepped forward and began to speak. However, no sound came from her mouth, and she looked at Aragorn with an expression of alarm. Aragorn tried to touch her mind with his own, but he could feel nothing of her thoughts. It was as if she were no longer in the room with them. Galbatorix laughed, then returned his sword to his lap, and leaned back in his throne.
"Did you truly believe that I was ignorant of your ability, child? Did you really think you could render me helpless with such a petty, transparent trick? Oh, I have no doubt your words could harm me, but only if I can hear them."
His bloodless lips curved in a cruel, humorless smile.
"Such folly. This is the extent of your plan? A girl who cannot speak unless I grant her leave? A spear more suited for hanging on a wall than carrying into battle? And a collection of Eldunari half out of their minds with age? Tut, tut. I had thought better of you, Arya, and you, Gleda. But then I suppose your emotions have clouded your reason, since I used Murtagh to slay Oromis."
To Aragorn, Saphira, and Arya, Gleda said,
"Kill him."
The golden dragon felt perfectly calm, but his very serenity betrayed an anger that surpassed all other emotions. Aragorn exchanged a quick glance with Arya and Saphira, and then the three of them started toward the dais, even as Gleda, Umaroth, and the other Eldunari attacked Galbatorix's mind. Before Aragorn managed to take more than a few steps, the king rose up from his velvet seat and shouted a word. The word reverberated within Aragorn's mind, and every part of his being seemed to thrum in response, as if he were an instrument upon which a bard had struck a chord. Despite the intensity of his response, Aragorn was unable to remember the word. It faded from his mind, leaving behind only the knowledge of its existence and how it had affected him. Galbatorix uttered other words after the first, but none seemed to have the same power, and Aragorn was too dazed to comprehend their meaning. As the last phrase left the king's lips, a force gripped Aragorn, stopping him in mid-stride. The jolt shook a yelp of surprise from him. He tried to move, but his body might as well have been encased in stone. All he could do was breathe, look, and as he had already discovered, speak. He did not understand. His wards should have protected him from the king's magic. That they did not left him feeling as if he were teetering on the edge of a vast abyss. Next to him, Saphira, Arya, and Elva appeared likewise immobilized. Enraged by how easily the king had caught them, Aragorn joined his mind with the Eldunari as they battered at Galbatorix's consciousness. He felt a vast number of minds opposing them, dragons all, who crooned and babbled and shrieked in a mad, disjointed chorus that contained such pain and sorrow. Aragorn wanted to pull himself away, lest they drag him down into their insanity. They were strong, too, as if most of them had been Glaida's size or larger. The opposing dragons made it impossible to attack Galbatorix directly. Every time Aragorn thought he felt the touch of the king's thoughts, one of the enslaved dragons would throw itself at Aragorn's mind and, gibbering all the while, force him to retreat. Fighting the dragons was difficult on account of their wild and incoherent thoughts. Subduing any one of them was like trying to hold down a rabid wolf. And there were so many of them, far more than the riders had hidden in the Vault of Souls. Before either side could gain the advantage, Galbatorix, who seemed entirely unaffected by the invisible struggle, said,
"Come out, my dears, and meet our guests."
A boy and a girl emerged from behind the throne and came to stand by the king's right hand. The girl looked about 6, the boy perhaps 8 or 9. They shared a close resemblance, and Aragorn guessed they were brother and sister. Both were dressed in their night garments. The girl clung to the boy's arm and half hid behind him, while the boy appeared frightened but determined. Even as he struggled against Galbatorix's Eldunari, Aragorn could feel the minds of the children, could feel their terror and confusion, and he knew they were real.
"Isn't she charming?" asked Galbatorix, lifting the girl's chin with one long finger. "Such large eyes and such pretty hair. And isn't he a handsome young lad?"
He put his hand on the boy's shoulder.
"Children, it is said, are a blessing to us all. I do not happen to share that belief. It has been my experience that children are every bit as cruel and vindictive as adults. They only lack the strength to subjugate others to their will. Perhaps you agree with me, perhaps you don't. Regardless, I know that you of the Varden pride yourselves on your virtue. You see yourselves as upholders of justice, defenders of the innocent, as if any are truly innocent, and as noble warriors fighting to right an ancient wrong. Very well, then. Let us test your convictions and see if you are what you claim to be. Unless you stop your attack, I shall kill these two."
He shook the boy's shoulder.
"And I shall kill them if you dare attack me again. In fact, if you displease me excessively, I shall kill them anyway. So I advise you to be courteous."
The boy and the girl appeared sick at his words, but they made no attempt to flee. Aragorn looked over at Arya, and he saw his despair mirrored in her eyes.
"Umaroth!"
they cried out.
"No!"
growled the white dragon, even as he wrestled with the mind of another Eldunari.
You have to stop, said Arya.
No.
He'll kill them, said Aragorn.
No, we will not give up. Not now. Enough, roared Glaedah. There are hatchlings in danger. And more hatchlings will be in danger if we do not kill the Eggbreaker.
Yes, but now is the wrong time to try, said Arya. Wait a little while, and perhaps we can find a way to attack him without risking the lives of the children.
And if not?
Asked Umaroth. Neither Aragorn nor Arya could bring themselves to answer.
Then we will do what we must, said Saphira.
Aragorn hated it, but he knew she was right. They could not place the two children before the whole of Alagazia. If possible, they would save the boy and the girl, but if not, then they would still attack. They had no other choice. As Umaroth and the Eldunari he spoke for grudgingly subsided, Galbatorix smiled.
There, that's better. Now we may speak as civilized beings, without worrying about who is trying to kill whom.
He patted the boy on the head, and then pointed toward the steps of the dais.
Sit.
Without arguing, the two children settled on the lowest step, as far from the king as they could get. Then Galbatorix motioned, and said,
Couster.
And Aragorn slid forward until he was standing at the base of the dais, as did Arya, Elva, and Saphira. Aragorn continued to be bewildered that their wards were not protecting them. He thought of the word, whatever it might have been, and a horrible suspicion began to take root within him. Hopelessness quickly followed. For all their plans, for all their talking and worrying and suffering, for all their sacrifices, Galbatorix had captured them as easily as he might a litter of newborn kittens. And if Aragorn's suspicion was true, the king was even more formidable than they had suspected. Still, they were not entirely helpless. Their minds were, for the moment, their own, and so far as he could tell, they could still use magic, one way or another. Galbatorix's gaze settled upon Aragorn.
So you are the one who has given me so much trouble, Aragorn, son of Morzan. You and I should have met long ago. Had your mother not been so foolish as to hide you in Carvajal, you would have grown up here in Urubain, as a child of the nobility, with all the riches and responsibilities that entails, instead of whiling away your days grubbing in the dirt.
Be that as it may, you are here now, and those things shall at last be yours. They are your birthright, your inheritance, and I shall see to it that you receive them. He seemed to study Aragorn with greater intensity, and then he said,
You look more like your mother than your father. With Murtagh, the opposite holds true. Still, it matters little. Whichever one you resemble most, it is only right that you and your brother should serve me, even as did your parents.
Never,
said Aragorn with a clenched jaw. A thin smile appeared on the king's face.
Never. We shall see.
His gaze shifted.
And you, Saphira, of all my guests today, I am gladdest to see you. You have grown to a fine adulthood. Do you remember this place? Do you remember the sound of my voice? I spent many a night talking to you and the other eggs in my charge, during the years when I was securing my rule over the Empire.
I remember a little, said Saphira,
and Aragorn relayed her words to the king. She did not want to communicate directly with the king, nor would the king have allowed it. Keeping their minds separate was the best way to protect themselves when not in open conflict. Galbatorix nodded